Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a special show because we are going to be starting off with an interview with a musician named Bruce Thompson, who played and sang with a bunch of groups. He has an interesting story about all the music he was involved with playing on and producing, so you should definitely plan to listen and keep tuned. So, first of all, thanks so much for coming down to the studio.
You're welcome.
Okay, so what part of Chicago are you from originally?
Well, first of all, my name is Reverend Bruce Thompson. I've dedicated my life to Jesus Christ.
Okay, sorry about that.
Okay, all right.
Sorry about that.
That's who I am now, when we're going to talk about who I was.
Okay.
Okay, so now you were saying, what was your...
So where are you from originally? Were you born in Chicago?
No, I was born in Indianapolis, Indiana. My father was Shoshone Indian, and he thought if he moved to Indianapolis, Indiana, the Indians would be free there. Boy, was he...
Didn't work out.
No, it didn't work out that way. But that was what his belief was. He believed that Indianapolis, Indiana was a place. So that's where I was born. And at the age of about 7 or 8, we moved to the Icky Projects in Chicago.
Yeah, last week I actually talked to someone else who was from the same projects, which is interesting because I've never interviewed anyone here who was from there before.
Okay.
So where specifically, where was it?
Well, my building was 40, it's still there because every time I pass by it, I show my children. They say, Dad, we now, you know, but anyway, 44 West 24th Street, and you can see it from that, you know, when you come... Coming to 22nd Street, entering Chinatown, heading north from on I-94.
Okay.
You know, it splits. One goes up and around, one goes down to 22nd. You can see my building right there, and I show it to anybody that when I go by, I let them know. That's where
so,
I'm from.
So what year did you move there?
I'm going to say it was 1959, that's a guess.
So they were there back then?
Oh, yes, sir. 1959 and 1960 at the latest.
Were they pretty new when you moved in?
Brand spanking new. Beautiful brands. Even the people that lived there were different than what wound up, you know, there. I mean, and now it seems to be a better people there now. But there was a time when that was a really rough area. I used to sneak out of the house and go back. When my parents moved to Morgan Park, you see, I must have been... that must have been 63 or 64. I would get on the bus when they were supposed to be sending me to school, and I'd go hang out back in the Ickies.
Okay.
And it got pretty rough. It got pretty rough after a while.
So how'd you first get involved with music?
My mother and father were musicians. My father sang bass for the Five Keys, and my mother...
The famous doo-wop group, the Five
Yeah,
Keys.
The Hucklebuck, Doo the Hucklebuck.
What was your father's name?
His name was Eddie Thompson, but that's not what he... His actual name was Eddie Thompson, but he didn't go by that in the group.
Do you remember what his name was in the group?
Don't remember.
Okay, but he was the bass singer?
He sang the bass.
And he's on some Five Keys records?
He's on a couple of them.
Okay.
Yeah, he's on a couple of them. Mm-hmm. And my mother played every song in the hymnal and let me know it was important to read music so that you could make money one day playing these songs. She told me when I was a little boy, she says, if you learn how to play the songs in this book, you'll never have to worry about a job. That's what I do. I've been doing it ever since. I work at church. I play organ at church.
So is that the instrument you originally learned how to play, the organ?
I think so. It was a piano. I mean, from the age of 2, there was a piano in the house. But I wasn't serious about it. It was just something there to beat on. And my mother would play it, and we would sing, you know. I got a recording of me singing, Open the Door, Richard, Richard, Why Don't... You remember that song?
Yeah.
Why Don't You Open... Had a little monologue in front.
Yeah.
And here was this 2-3-year-old boy. Where you been? Where you been? I mean, a little bitty light voice and everything. Doing the whole monologue and everything is amazing. I don't even remember doing it.
Okay.
I don't even remember doing it. I could, you know, I only played it and said, Mama said, that's you, boy, you know.
So you learned to play organ and piano at a young age.
Yes.
And then what's the first music you were involved with, like a band or recording? When did that happen?
I'm going to guess, well, you know, I had my own little reel-to-reel recorder. I inherited from my dad. So I was always recording, you know, slowing the tape down, you know, going, and slow it down, sounding like cars and things. So I was always experimenting with the tape recorder, you know, speeding it up, sounding like the Munchkins, all you know, the Three Chipmunks or whatever, you know. So recording, I don't know where that began. It was all a blur to me.
So you obviously were involved with sort of record, like studio type stuff, recording yourself.
It was reel-to-reel recording.
But what is the first band you were in that ended up recording?
I'm going to guess that would have been Raw Umber.
Okay, but you said you also played in a band on an Emotions record, is that right?
Yeah, So I Can Love You.
How did that happen?
There was this man named Bill Neely, and he was there at the Henry Booth House, which is right there in the middle of the Icky Projects. And even though it was several years after I moved away, you know, I never really too much broke the ties right there in the projects there. And he invited us to Henry Booth House, and he says he's going to make records, and we're going to be famous, and we're going to be rich. And come on in here, and we practiced, and we practiced, and we practiced, and we went to the studio and recorded. We recorded more than that. We recorded four or five songs at that same time.
Okay.
And I didn't at that time meet the Emotions. I've met them since, but I didn't even know who they were.
So was your band, you didn't have a name of the band, it was just some guys that got together?
No, Bill Neely just hooked the, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you're saying you play on the released version of So I Can Love You?
Yes.
Because that has a prominent organ part right at the beginning.
Yes.
Because I'm looking now, and at least it was released on Stax Volt Records.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And at least on the record it says produced by Isaac Hayes and David Porter. Do you know, like, so did they sell it to them, or what was the story?
Well, I guess so.
Okay.
I don't know.
But there's not Memphis musicians on those records. It's you guys on the released versions.
Yes.
And so that was like 69?
Chicago musicians, yeah.
That was like 69, something like that?
I was in high school, so I'm going to say yeah.
What high school did you go to?
Morgan Park High School. They kicked me out of there, and I went to Harlan High
okay.
School.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of groups from both schools, actually.
Yeah.
Do you remember some of the groups that were in Morgan Park when you were there?
I should. He wasn't from there. I don't know. Wasn't everybody from Morgan Park? I mean, you know, when I think back of the music, you're asking some tough questions.
Okay, and when you were and obviously the most famous group from Harlan was the Five Stair Steps.
I don't know, the Sequins got pretty big.
Yeah, the
too.
Sequins were big too, yeah. The Five Stair Steps, there were like a lot of, the Specials were from there, the Rotations, there were a lot of groups from Harlem.
So you know more than me. I should be interviewing you.
But
tell us about that.
But I wasn't in school with these people, so.
Oh, yeah, well, I met the Sequins in Harlem, and the Sock Hops were exciting. Oh, the Morgan Park Sock Hops were just amazing. The groups that would come there. I mean, it was stiff competition. You know, we would compete. We'd have a battle of the bands and all those kind of things, and some fantastic musicians. But see, I seem like I'm left here all alone now. John Walls, who played with 24 Karat Black, he's Vance Kelly's organ player now. He's bass player for 24 Karat Black.
Okay.
He's Vance Kelly's organ player now.
Okay.
Keyboard player now. So he's still here, but. As I look around me, I'm standing alone, it seems. So I really, it's hard to remember all those people from back there. I remember the guys that are still standing. I work with Sam Savage now. You know, he's a fabulous singer. And I work with him all around the Chicago area. So I know him. But
so you're not in contact with a lot of the people from back in the day?
John Walls is about the only one that I've talked to. I talked to Rayford Smith, who went on after 24 Karat Black and went to, with Miles Davis, started recording some stuff with Miles Davis, guitar player.
Well, we'll get to the 24 Karat Black stuff. So you said the next group that you ended up recording with was Raw Umber. And that was actually a band that you were officially a member of.
Yes, I was a member of Raw Umber.
So how did that happen? When, like... to the emotion So I Can Love You, that was like 69, 70, something like that. And the Raw Umber was, I think, you know, early to mid-70s, something like that. Was that, so were you involved with music up to that point? What were you doing?
You see, it's hard to say, because see, for sure, on July 21st, 1971, I joined the Air Force. Okay, that's for sure. Okay, so now, Raw Umber came before that. So now, I think Raw Umber might have come before the other stuff. Because, see, Raw Umber was a group that I, as a kid, you know, I went to go see them play.
Okay.
They didn't have no keyboard player. It was just the two guitars, bass, and drums, man. And they was kicking it, right?
Okay.
And so I would go and see them, and the whole, all the neighborhoods were talking about them, and, you know, just a big fuss. And Greg McGee's dad was spending money on the group.
Okay, and they were a Morgan Park group?
Morgan Park group.
Okay.
Well, actually, the house that we rehearsed in was in Maple Park, which was just across the street. Okay, go figure, okay.
Okay.
115th Street was the dividing line between Morgan Park and Maple Park. And they lived one block on the other side of Morgan Park. And I lived one block on the other side of Maple Park. I lived on 114th. They lived on 116th. They all lived in one building. All
okay.
lived in, except for me, because I lived up the street. But this was a group that had joined together with one purpose, to make it in the music business, and that meant sacrifice, and that meant, hey, we all have to chip in on the gig money that we made this week and buy enough food for us all to eat for the next week until the next gig. You know, so it was just moving to me.
So they were a band that was already together before you...
Before I got with them, yeah.
Because I interviewed a guy named Kevin Rowan, and he was
a drummer.
Yeah, he was in the Mystiques, and the Mystiques, members of them, became Raw Umber, and Kevin was in the group for a while, too, I think.
I don't ever remember Kevin being in the group.
I think right at the beginning he was in the group. So you joined, and I have one of the records I'm going to play. Are you on this record?
I'm on the records.
So you're on this record, Love One Another.
That's right. That's me on keyboards.
Okay, well, let me play the record and we can talk some more.
Good, let's play it. I haven't heard it, man, in 30 years. I'm excited.
So this is Raw Umber with Bruce Thompson, who's up in here, and he's playing keyboards on this record. This track is called Love One Another. Okay, that was just Raw Umber with Love One Another. And if you're just tuning in, I have a guy named Bruce Thompson who played keyboards on that record and who played on a bunch of stuff and who sang on some stuff and produced some stuff. So that record, you said it must have been done before you went to the Air Force.
It had to be.
Early 70s sometime, like 70, 71, something like that.
Man, it could have been 69, you see.
Okay.
It could have been 69.
And so you don't know how long the group Raw Umber was together before you joined them, mm-hmm. but you just saw them playing around Morgan Park.
Yeah.
And so when you joined them, were you, like, was it music full-time you were doing, or you were working and then playing in the band?
I was in high school.
Oh, okay, you were still in high school.
Yeah.
At Morgan Park High School.
At Morgan Park High School.
Okay, so.
So that's why it had to be 69, you see, because
okay.
70, I went to Harlan.
Okay.
It had to be 69.
Were the other guys older than you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was always with guys older than me, never younger.
And so how did it work when you were in high school? Did you just do shows with them? Like how often did you do shows?
I was a very poor student. I would sneak out of the house sometimes in the middle of the night. I'd stick that organ, I had a little portable organ, I'd stick that sucker out the window, and then I'd climb out after it. You know,
okay.
But that's how I had to get out of the house. You know, my mother did not approve of me, this kind of music. You know, she wanted me to be she would take me, my mother would take me to go see Andre Watts. You know who Andre Watts is?
He's a
black classic pianist.
Okay.
That's who I went to see.
I didn't know that, actually.
Yes, okay. So that's who Andre Watts. I would ask her, Mom, who's the greatest piano player in the world? She would say, Liberace. She didn't say anything about his sexual gender or anything of that. It's just that he was the greatest pianist in all of the world. And certainly, when I saw him play, man, he definitely was a fantastic piano player. So that was not her idea. So I would have to sneak out to go and do my James Brown thing. You know what I'm saying? To go play what my peers wanted to hear.
Okay.
So I would sneak out. I would sneak out of the house. That's what I would do.
And you were involved with all three records that Raw Umber cut.
Yes.
They cut 345, that one I just
Absolutely.
Played, and then two under the name Gregory McGee, but it was Raw Umber,
Absolutely. Yep.
The band on
That's
it.
That's right.
And so you said you sneaked out. What types of places was the band playing?
Well, actually, when I first started sneaking out, it had to be 1967 because I had just got in high school, so... what's the name of that place? 87th and Ashland, the Carl Davis Palace. I remember now. The Carl Davis Palace. I was in the house band there called the Tough Turfs.
Okay.
And boy, we were tough, man. We had the four singers and they also didn't have a keyboard player. And they were also the rhythm section for the sequence.
Okay, that's interesting.
Okay, they were the rhythm section for the sequence.
So that was before you were in Raw Umber. You were in.
Oh yeah, this was before.
It was called the Tough
the
Turfs.
The Tough Turfs.
Okay.
TURFS, I believe.
So you played behind the sequence when they did shows.
No.
Okay.
Recording studio.
Okay.
In the recording studio.
Because I think Hey Romeo came out around 69 or 70.
Well, I didn't play that. It doesn't sound familiar to me.
But that was their hit record, Hey Romeo. I would sing it, but I can't sing. So that was like the first official band you were in, the Tough Turfs?
Oh, no. The first official band... But you said you prerequisited the other one with recording a record. Now, the first official band would have been Sansui Siplukas Defunk Incorporated. That was a band created in my freshman year in high school.
Okay.
And
Morgan Park.
Yeah.
So when you finally got together with Raw Umber, you were also still in high school.
Still in high school, and it wasn't long after that. It was very soon after that, because Sansui Siplukas did not want to make no money. And every time I saw Raw Umber, they was on stage making some money. You know what I'm saying?
So what type of places did you play with them?
Raw Umber?
Yeah.
I didn't. I only played in the studio.
Oh, okay. You were only in the studio.
Yeah. When I joined the group, it was not important to play gigs. It was important to get recordings out so that we could play the big gigs. We're tired of playing these little bitty gigs here. We want to make some good recordings so we can, you know.
Do you remember where you recorded those tracks?
good gracious, no. I'm going to have to say no to that.
Okay. So how long were you with Raw Umber?
Till the drummer went into the Army.
Okay. And then did you go soon after that to the Air Force?
And then I went soon after that. When he went to the Army, it seemed like everything was lost, you know. Everything was crazy. I let the Disciples Street Gang be my best friends after that, and they wanted to rob a cleaner's, and I knew how to start a car. See, I could start a car, man, any car like that. I could take a piece of wire this big and start your car and be gone.
Okay.
So I didn't want to be beat up, so I wanted to show them how cool I was. I started a car, and we robbed a cleaner's. And be sure the judge gave me a choice. You can be sentenced to time, or you can join the military. And I joined the military.
Okay, so that was in 71.
July 21st, 1971.
So when did you get back to Chicago?
October 18th, 1973 was my discharge date, but I left 4 months before there. So what is that? Before October. Can you count months backwards?
Like June or something like that.
Your guess is as good as mine.
So
right in there.
So
right in there. I came back to Chicago.
So you had mentioned earlier in the interview you got involved with a group called 24 Karat Black.
Right.
Is that the first music thing you got involved with when you came back to Chicago?
No. The first musical thing, what was they called? Doggone it. They were called Airborne.
Okay.
Airborne was the name of that group.
And but they did they ever record anything?
No, we didn't record. We worked Holiday Inns. And
were you living in Morgan Park again?
No. Where was I I lived in Markham.
Okay.
Illinois. When I came back, there was no place for me to live. I was grown and on my own, right?
Okay.
So I met a musician from Markham. His name is Millard Edwards. He changed his name to Tommy Edwards later.
Okay.
Because of 24 Karat Black, but we'll get to that.
Okay, but was it Mill? There was a Mill Edwards who was in a bunch of groups.
Mill, his father was Mill Edwards of the
Esquires and the Shepherds.
And the Shepherds, that's right.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so when did you join? Were you in some other groups before 24 Karat Black?
That was the only one, the group that we had, and I think it was called Airborne. And then we worked at the Dixie Square Wurlitzer organ. You know, I knew I could get work. You know, even when I was in the air during the Air Force, I found the nearest organ sales place, and I'd go make me some money off duty, man. You know what I'm saying? I'm gonna go because I could make the organ talk. You know, I can know how to play organ. You know, and so I worked at the Wurlitzer organ, and it was my job to draw big crowds in front of the.
Where was the store?
150.
But it was
Highway.
Okay, was south side outside of the city?
Yeah, just south of the city. You
okay.
know, just south of the line, and. And there I met the advance man, which is what most groups had to have when they were traveling from spot to spot to spot. And this advance man told me a story about 24 Karat Black. He said, look, man, we just lost our keyboard player, our bass player, and our guitar player. Do you know where some dudes that play like you play that'll play them other two spots and can go?
Okay.
And I knew a couple of guys, John Walls and Rayford Smith, and I hooked them up.
So they were just some musicians you knew from your neighborhood or from Chicago?
Yeah, from the neighborhood. They weren't even in the group that I had put together.
So so can you give some background who 24 Karat Black were? Because they recorded an album, which is sort of a legendary funk album. But where are they from originally and who are they?
They were called the Ditalians. From Cincinnati, Ohio, and they hooked up with Dale Osmond Warren, who was the producer of that record and my mentor for a few years after that, you know.
And so they had recorded an album called Ghetto Misfortunes Wealth, which is kind of a famous collectible album, and it was sampled by Eric B. and Rakim. It's like a famous rap sample.
Right.
So are you on that album?
Or no, I'm not on that album.
So you joined after that was recorded?
I joined right after that was recorded. And yes, it's legendary. My son, who's a hip-hop producer, Anthony Tone, 12 Tones. I'm sorry, son. I got to pronounce it right. 12 Tones. He's, according to him, he says, if you're a record producer, a hip-hop producer, and you show up at the studio session without some 24 karat black, he says, you're not even authentic, you know. So yes, I know it's historic, legendary.
So the band was touring around the U.S. or whatever, and they were that record came out on Enterprise Records, like Stax Records,
right?
And so you joined the touring band at that point,
right?
So were there were still some guys from the Detalions, and then the how many guys did you bring in? Three guys.
Three guys.
Was you and two other guys.
Yeah.
So you started touring with the band.
Right.
Where did you go?
Well, the first place we went was Atlanta. Man, I left here in a limousine. I left Chicago. A limousine came to my house and picked me up and took me away in a limousine. And I came back in a U-Haul trailer, in the back of a U-Haul trailer. But we went to Atlanta. That's where we went. It was, and I can remember almost when, because it made no sense to me to play somewhere on Christmas. So this was just, I'm going to say it was December 18th when all of this happened.
Do you remember what year?
1973.
73, okay.
Yeah, 1970. Oh, for sure. 1970.
Okay.
Like I said, right after the album was, I don't know when the album was recorded, but right, had to be right after that, because its release was sometime in 73. And so we went to Atlanta, and we had to learn how to play. Okay, I was a young man. I mean, I knew how to play. But there's another thing about playing music, a professional level. You know, nobody's supposed to miss it. I mean, let me put it this way.
They were the first, like, big band you toured with. Is that what you're trying to...
Yes. Is that true? Yes. And you know what? During the military, I played with some fabulous bands. In Mississippi, Carl Gates and the New Breed just came back to me. He took me all over the place.
Okay.
And he had the organ and everything. He needed somebody to play. Carl Gates and New Breed. I remember him. Anyway, what was the question?
You said it was December of 1973.
Yes, December 18th. I'm going to think is the date, because it was just a few days before Christmas, and 18th is sticking out in my mind. And because I remember being so lonely, and the club was so empty on December 25th, 1973, you know, and I was so naive and stupid, I thought that the club should be full on Christmas. And, of course, I've learned since then that that's the loneliest night in entertainment, you know, is December 25th. But... we went there. You see, we had to learn how to play, and so big band was they can't we could we I can't say they were a big band then. Then we had an album, but we were not a big band. The Commodores weren't even a big band then. You know, the Commodores were still scratching, trying to come out there. As a matter of fact, we ran into them several times down there in the South, because we toured the whole South, man, every place. And see, the trick was to get to a town that has a radio station. See, they should have said something about that before. No one said anything. But when I think back on it, every town we went to had a radio station. So I put two and two together, you know. Go to the town with the radio station. You can get booked on the air. You got your record. You do a commercial. Somebody's getting cut in some money some kind of way, I guess. Because if the radio station doesn't say, well, 24 Karat Black is going to be at So on the Blue Rider at 7 o'clock next Saturday night, ain't nobody going to know they're there. So, but I don't know all those things. But we would always play at the places where there were radio stations. And Dale Warren and Manchurian. Robert Manchurian, you ever heard that name?
No.
Okay, I'll just, Mama says you can't say nothing nice.
Okay.
So I'm just going to leave it right there. But
okay.
Manchurian, he was sort of the roadie turned singer for the group.
Okay.
He was actually a high-level valet.
Okay.
And then he, when the group broke down, they lost those three members, and they lost a couple of girl singers, too, as a matter of fact, because we had to bring on a couple of more girl singers. at that time, two of the girls stayed and two of the girls stayed. Because, you know, it was a big group. The group was actually made up of several pieces. See, we had Les Fleurs Ebonnais. Ebonnais, I hope I'm saying that right. Les Fleurs Ebonnais, that was the girl.
Okay.
And ladies and gentlemen, Les Fleurs Ebonnais, and they would come out and they'd do their act. We had an act.
Okay.
It wasn't just sing some songs. We had an act. We had enough visual candy for your eyes to just see all night long. And we were part of, the rhythm section was called Con Brio.
Okay.
And I guess this was all Dale Warren's. This is all in Dale Warren. And the horn sections had another name, and I don't, for the life of me, remember what they were called. So anyway, the total of us were 17. There were 17 of us, not counting, I mean, and that's counting everything, the road crews, the stage hands, valets, road managers, etc., you know.
Okay.
So I don't know how we got there. Where am I going?
So I was just trying to find out what happened with the group you toured, and you were talking about playing in December. How long did the group stay together?
2 years.
Okay, so you toured two with years. Them for 2 years till like 75, something
about
like
75,
that.
About 75, yeah.
And then why did the group break up?
The group broke up because I got married.
Okay, so you just left?
They wanted to go to Boston.
Okay.
We hadn't seen Dale for a year. I had been out there without Dale for a year, and that was kind of bad. Maybe 9 months, you know, not having him there. Because even though we weren't making money, he was a constant source of knowledge for me. So I would have been satisfied as long as he was there feeding me knowledge, you know, keeping me growing in all aspects, you know. But he went on to go and do the movie, The Klansman.
Okay.
With Richard Burton, Lee Marvin, and O.J. Simpson.
Okay.
And David Harrison, Cameron Mitchell. You know, it was a pretty big movie. He went on, and that's deservedly so. You know, go get the money, you know what I'm saying? But then they wanted to go to Boston. And I'm like, you know, there's no Dale Warren. Boston is where the gangsters are. Please don't get mad at me, gangsters.
So
that's, you know, I was afraid to go. I had a new wife. We had been married a few months.
So you went back to Chicago?
Well, we were actually in Michigan when the decision was made.
And
I was either going to Chicago or to Boston. I went to Chicago.
So how come they didn't just replace you and keep going?
Because I was their last hope. Stax Records had stopped giving us money some years earlier. I think not long after I joined Stax Records. One day, Dale showed me the check. It was $40,000. It was from Stax Records. It was to pay our hotel bills and to keep us out there on the promotional tour. And then one day, the checks stopped.
Okay, so you stopped getting the push, the money.
Put
in
us all in jail. We got put in jail for, what do you call it, when you're trying to evade paying your rent evasion, whatever it is. You know, the hotel bill had gotten up to $4,000 or $5,000, and we had no way of paying it. We were expecting this check come from Stax, and Dale was scratching his head. Nobody knew what the heck was going on. I didn't know, and we all wound up in jail.
So you had been with the group a couple more years. Did you ever record any more material?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely.
But it was just never released?
Never released.
Okay. But it was supposed. Was there supposed to be a whole second album on Stax?
Absolutely.
And it just never got released.
I'm assuming it was supposed to be on Stax Records, because that's who Dale.
Okay.
That's who Dale was doing all his stuff through. It wasn't the Mad Lads.
Yeah, Stax? They were on Stax also. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was with Stax, and that's what Dale did. He did the.
So you came back to Chicago, and did you form a group called Chocolate Sunday after that?
Right after that.
What was the story with that?
Well, at that time, see, I left something out, because at that time, Jeff Clare was the drummer for 24 Karat Black. So, some other members left again. You dig what I'm saying?
Okay.
It was the original members, then the three plus the two girls left, and then another group of them left. So now let me remember who was left when we were there. We had... I'm going to tell you, I really don't remember how Jeff got involved in it. But Jeff was there, and the bass player was there, and the guitar player was there. So the Chicago contingent, we went back to Chicago.
Okay.
We left Michigan and went back to Chicago.
And you formed a band called Chocolate Sunday out of the guys that left 24 Karat Black.
Right.
Okay, well, we've been talking for a while. Let me play the record that Chocolate Sunday recorded, and then we could talk some more.
Okay.
So this is the record by Chocolate Sunday, and you're actually singing lead on this record,
right?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
This is called Second Story Man. Okay, that was just Chocolate Sunday with Second Story Man. And if you're just tuning in, I have Bruce Thompson up in here who was singing lead on that record, the Reverend Bruce Thompson.
Thank you.
And so that record, we were just talking about how the group Chocolate Sunday was a band, and it was formed out of the guys from Chicago who were touring with 24 Karat Black. And you guys came back to Chicago. So what is the actual lineup of Chocolate Sunday?
The bass player was John Walls, although John Walls didn't play on this tape. He was arrested for, I think he killed the guy, murder. the day before. He shot somebody. Let me be accurate. He shot someone the day before our great session. I borrowed all my mother's money, my auntie's money, everybody's money to get in here and do this session. The record company, Dynamic, they gave me a certain amount of money, but everything was dependent upon that record that you just played. So
okay.
So John got put in jail. I wasn't going to cancel the session, but he was the bass player. He's on the 24 karat black tapes, though.
Okay.
John Walsh. Then there's Jeffrey Clare on the drums, Reginald Morris on the guitar, and myself on piano, organ, and bass guitar.
So, and it was, that's the first, is that the first record you were on where you're actually singing on it?
Singing lead, yes.
So, had you had experience singing before, or?
Well, I mean, you know, the parents' church, you know, most of the cats that's out here now began in church. And then at some point or another, they decide whether they're going to go to blues or go to jazz or going to go to classical or wherever they're going to go. The first audience for me was in church.
Okay.
That was the first audience I had. And like I say, most of black entertainers, singers, their first audience is in church.
So that band Chocolate Sunday, you formed immediately after you came back to Chicago?
Yeah, immediately.
What was the, where'd you get the name idea from, the name of the band?
I don't know. Probably Jeff. He could talk me into anything.
Okay. You know? And you pretty much formed the band, is that right?
Yeah.
And so what's the story? How'd you, what was Dynamic Records, the label you just mentioned it got released on?
Dynamic Records was two seemingly well-to-do gentlemen who had come to one of my shows who thought that they could make some money off of Second Story Man. Actually, they were after that song right there. That's all they really wanted.
So they saw Chocolate Sunday play at a show.
They saw Chocolate
and you
Sunday,
did that
yeah.
song.
We were playing at a place called the Devil's Palace on 159th Street.
Okay.
And this was a cool place. It had telephones on all the tables, so if you wanted to talk to a girl, you dial her table number. Hey, baby, I'm sending a drink over, whatever, you know. Or if you wanted to be a knife, you was an ugly dude, you didn't tell her who you were, you know. But it was kind of a neat place, and he heard us in there, and he says, I want that song. He says, I've been thinking about starting a record company, and, you know, that song, that's your original song? I says, yeah, that's my original song. He says, well, I want to record it. So I says, okay, we can record it. I said, but he says, what is it going to take? So I don't know what I must have told him, but it wound up I was the manager of a studio he didn't have before we talked.
Okay.
Because this was my aspiration to run a recording studio, which I have one now, which is possibly the greatest recording studio on earth.
Okay.
But, I wanted to be at the controls of the recording studio, and he bought a recording studio, a small 8-track Tascam recording studio, and we practiced on that thing and practiced and practiced, and then we went to the studio. I recorded Nicky Buzz there. I recorded The Split Evolution there.
Where was the studio?
Right next to Channel 7, 162 North State.
Okay.
That sound right?
I wouldn't know where Channel 7 was.
I think Channel 7 is 180 North.
So
162 North.
So
State.
Are you saying that you they funded the studio and
yes.
you but so did they own the studio?
They owned it.
Okay, but
they owned it.
But I
worked it.
And so they put out that record on you, and I know that record is very obscure. What did they just not distribute it at all? What's the story?
I showed up at the studio for work one day, and the studio was gone.
Okay.
So
they just pressed it, and then they ran out of money or something.
They had three records. They had the Nicky Buzz Band, or maybe they were going to do Split Evolution, and
okay,
you know, and ran out of money right then. Maybe that's what happened. I don't know. But the Split Evolution stuff was all prepared at the same time. Jump Street.
Okay, so you were like the engineer on the Split Evolution record.
I was a producer of Jump Street.
Okay.
The producer.
Yeah, it came out on a label called Wasp Records.
Mm.
Who do you remember? So what was Split Evolution? Was
Split
it a
Evolution
was a vocal
was
group?
Three guys that sang.
Who were the guys' names?
Vern Lindsay sticks out in my mind, and I wouldn't deny if I heard their name, the other two, but I just can't remember. I never really talked to the other two guys very much.
Okay.
Vern Lindsay, though, was the one I spoke with mostly.
And so did you play music on their record, too? There were three.
Yeah, I'm a musician on the track, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I know...
I think I'm playing two keyboards on there, piano and an organ.
So they released a record called Jump Street, and it came out on Wasp Records. And later in 1980, they released a record of the name Three Phases of Evolution.
Yeah.
And you actually have writing credits on that song.
Along with someone else, and that's just not true.
Okay.
Vern, that's not true. I wrote that song all by myself.
So that track is called If You Would Only Say I Love You.
Yes, yes.
And so at that time, did you get more into sort of producing music?
It
was
just
76 around that time.
I was just always, you know, when I was a kid, man, I had a Billy Preston record, and I just looked at his name on there, and I listened to him, and I just wanted my name to be on some records, man. That was the whole dream. No, photographer, background vocalist, makeup man, just put me on an album cover.
Okay.
I want to see my name on the album cover. So, and then when I did my early records, you know, I opened my own recording studio too in about, I'm going to guess and say 78.
Okay, so soon after that, working at that studio, you opened your own studio?
Opened my own recording studio, yes.
What was your studio called?
It was called Ye Old Sound Shop. I'm sure I had that name. That's what it's called now. I'm thinking I named it that then.
Where was it located?
The first studio was in my basement. I had tricked the basement out. I was on 91st and Merrill. 91st and Merrill or something like that. And then I opened a studio on 920 South Michigan Avenue. That's where it was called.
Okay.
Ye Old Sound Shop. I don't, like I say, when I first opened, I don't know if I was calling it that, but it was called Ye Old Sound Shop. And I was at 920 South Michigan till 1986. So I was there almost.
So a lot of people recorded at your studio.
Man, In 1983 or 84, I recorded, I made $50,000 that year, $53,000. I never made no money like that recording.
Just like people paid you for studio time?
People paid me for studio time, yeah.
And do you remember some of the bigger things that got recorded at your studio?
Yeah, I recorded R. Kelly's first record.
Okay.
I recorded R. Kelly there. I recorded, he came in one day with Craig Hodges, the basketball player. You know, he had somehow talked Craig Hodges into backing him. And so Craig Hodges knew about the studio, so that's A&A. So he came in and recorded.
That was after Public Announcement, or like his first solo?
It was before Public.
Okay.
It was before the big contest, right? MGM. Didn't he have a group?
I think it was called Public Announcement, wasn't it?
I thought it was R. Kelly and MGM, but this was before that singer lady. What's her name? Natalie Cole, wasn't her show the one that broke it for him?
I think so.
Right, he had a TV show that broke. This was before the television show.
So what year did you record R. Kelly?
I'm gonna guess and say 81.
Oh, that far back?
I'm guessing maybe
okay.
82, 83, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just guessing.
And at the time, after that Chocolate Sunday record, did Chocolate Sunday stay together as a band? Like, did you guys keep playing for a while?
We did some gigs, but my interest in the recording studio pretty much broke that up because the guys were jealous, and one arranged for me to have a robbery. They home invaded, you know, because I lived in the studio too. My family lived there, my wife and all my children. And one of the members of the band arranged to have us kicked in, have the door broken into and home invaded. I was on a gig and, you know, he sent them after the drum machine. Can you imagine that? It was a man jealous of a drum machine. But it broke the group up pretty much. I never saw him after that.
Okay.
You know, once that happened, you know, it wasn't like he showed up the next thing and said, "Wow, what happened?" No, I just didn't see him anymore. He never came. So he, you know, it was pretty much obvious who did it, you know.
Okay.
And
so the group broke up and you focused on recording and engineering.
Well, not long after that, I joined the Mel Hayes and the Boogeyman Orchestra.
Do you play on Lady, Lady, Lady?
No, I didn't play. Again, I was just a little bit late.
Okay.
Right. And I worked with him 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
5 or 6 years.
What types of places did they play?
We played mostly Holiday Inns and, you know, this kind of venue. Five nights a week we played. If they had 5 night-a-week work, that's where we were.
Okay.
You know, we did 39 states and several countries. We did Canada, did Mexico, and, you know, some close by.
Okay. Yeah, I know you got mentioned in the Jimmy Mays interview as singing on some of his tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So were you mainly engineering by the 80s?
You see, when the people would come to the studio and they're going to record. See, I wanted to be able to take the risk out of music business. And I saw that the recording studio was that way because people are always going to be in the studio trying to record their music, get their music recorded down. And the first recording was great. The photographer comes in, and I said, I wonder how much he makes. When I found out he made $10,000 or $1,000, I got me a camera, man.
Okay.
And so the next customer came in, he got sound and a picture. Click. Okay. And then when I found out that mastering took place, I bought me a little mastering suite.
Okay.
Said, we're going to get all the money. You know, if you got one stop right here, you're going to get it all done right here.
Okay.
Then the duplication, you know, I got duplicators now. So I got into the duplicator. Each step I took, you know, now if you want to shoot a video, hey, I got it, baby. I got high def.
Okay.
It's high def from front end to back with a professional editing suite and a 42-inch mic. I mean, I got it. You see what I'm saying? I'm not letting none of that money get away. So somebody walk into my door right now and he needs a professional recording and a video made, we're not letting no money get away, man.
Okay.
So we just gonna, and I taught my sons how to do different jobs. And today, one, you know, when the computers and music married, that made me a computer expert. I don't know if you understand that.
Okay.
But if your specialty is on the computer, you can become a computer expert too. I mean, if you like fishing and they got a fishing and tackle program, you buy it, and you on it 24 hours, you know, it won't take long. You're going to be very proficient in computers. And so one of my sons, he does computers. And then the graphics, like nobody, they came in there and they said they're going to pay a graphic designer to put an album cover together. You're going to pay him what? That's all right. Just hold on. I got you covered. You know what I'm saying? So I did the album. Now one of my sons has his degree in graphic design.
Okay.
And then another one of my sons, he punched his first punch in when he was 7 years old. Honest to God, we was in a session with Jock Carter. He was a guy that came in. He had a record. Jock Carter, did you get his? Jock Carter?
Yeah, I have one of them.
You do?
Yeah, it's like a 45. So you were involved with a lot of Chicago music recording.
Right.
And you've been involved with your studio since the 80s, is that right? Like continuously?
The first real studio was what Dynamic bought me.
Okay. And then you started your own.
And then I started my own shortly after that. I saved up all my money so I could buy it. And anyway, Jock Carter was in a session, and he says, "Man, we can't get this part right." I said, "Man, you're on studio time right now. You got to pay if you want to rehearse." I said, "Y'all should have rehearsed at home." He said, "Well, look, we'll make a deal. Just go off the clock for a while, and I'll pay you X number of dollars for a rehearsal," right? So I said, okay, and I went to sleep because I was kicking it in hand and foot, you know. I was running that studio 24 hours a day. So I went to sleep right there at the mixing board. I woke up, my oldest son was, he did a little tenor voice, "You ready to do it again?" He was punching him in, man. I couldn't believe he was punching him in. So he owns his own recording studio. He's made about 15 or 16 albums now. He's on 15, 16 albums to chip off the old block. You know,
okay.
They're 12 tones. Yeah.
So some of the bigger productions and things you engineered, you talked about R. Kelly.
Okay, bigger productions, well, maybe not big in your mind, but I wrote the Shy Lights last album.
Okay.
Okay.
So
called Heroes.
So you didn't record it, but you wrote it.
I wrote it. I wasn't the
okay.
The producer of it.
Okay. How'd you get involved with that?
I had been pretty much chasing Marshall down for years to try to listen to what I could do.
Okay.
Not only him, but the Staple Singers and anybody else that I thought might be able to pay me for my craft, you know.
Okay.
I'd chase him. If I heard you was close, I'm going to chase you down, you know. So I just happened to catch him one time with a good song.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what are some of the other things that you wrote or produced?
I'm coming up blank now, but...
Okay.
Some other things.
Well,
I'm on over 160 albums. My okay. name, Graces.
Okay.
Over 160. So now let's see. I did some Chaka Khan recordings. I did some recordings for Curtis Mayfield. I recorded some. I should have wrote this down before I got here because I should have known you was going to ask me that.
Well. I could play one of the things that you did, that Split Evolution Jump Street, and
okay.
we could talk some more.
Okay.
So this is the record that you said you recorded at the Dynamic Studios before they went under.
You're going to play Jump Street?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a Split Evolution, and there's three guys singing, and you're playing in the band on this.
Yes, and it's an early Bruce Thompson production.
Okay, here it is.
Hey, you better watch your back. Right out here on Jump Street. And you worked all week coming home, but you say there's a man with a gun trying to take it away. And you know that you worked so hard, my Lord. Cause without your money, your family might starve. But you give it up, cause you know your life. Out here on Jump Street. There's an old lady who lives down the street. Yeah, she's old, but she's kind of pretty. Yeah. And she just got robbed right out here on Jump Street. Hey, pimps and pushers are getting over to the bar. All the best in the Jump Street. Hey, you a fancy thing you give to the store. There's a bunch of junkies outside. Yeah.
Okay, that was just a group called Split Evolution with Jump Street, and it was produced by Bruce Thompson, who was up in here telling his story. So before playing that record, we had talked about how there was a large number of musical productions that he has done over the last, I guess, almost 30 years that you've been working as a recording engineer and producer. So are you doing music today? Are you producing anything?
Oh, yes,
recording
yes.
Anything?
Oh, yes. I'm producing and performing music pretty much all the time. Right now, I'm the organ player for Rock of Ages Missionary Baptist Church at 1250 South Pulaski, and I'm also associate pastor of New Christian Life House of Prayer and Faith at 820 East 75th Street. And I also wanted you to know that my mother is I have to give her the fault of everything that I'm doing, because she made me into a young person who was never confused. She would drop me off every Saturday morning at the Chicago Conservatory of Music so that I could learn how to read and write music. And then after that, I would take the bus over to see Ralph Jones at 43rd in Indiana. He was Mahalia Jackson's organ player. And when he was in town, he would show me how to play the organ. So I had the best of both worlds, classically trained in the soulful, inspirational teaching of this man, Ralph Jones. And I just wanted y'all to know that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So thanks so much for coming down and telling your story. Mm-hmm. Do you have any last words for the listening audience?
Do what you love. You may starve for a while, but do what you love and you'll never be stuck doing what you hate.
That's good advice.